Welcome back to the program. Eat local has become the mantra of a whole generation of food activists. Implicit in the locavore argument is the belief that it combines healthy eating and a high standard of environmental stewardship, while at the same time delivering important economic benefits, increasing food security within local economies. My guest today, geographer Pierre Desroches, seriously questions the locavore perspective. Desroches concludes that eating local only delivers increased social and economic misery, that it contributes to environmental degradation, and in fact creates greater food insecurity, as well as potentially poorer nutrition. We're going to talk about this today with respect to Desroches' book, The Locavore's Dilemma. Pierre Desroches is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto. He was a research fellow at the Center for History of Political Economy at Duke, and he has a Master's of International Public Policy from Osaka University. It is my pleasure to welcome Pierre Desroches here to talk about The Locavore's Dilemma in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. Pierre, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Is this, or should we think of this, in terms of being a zero-sum game? Can we make the argument that, in fact, our global food supply is a valuable commodity, and at the same time that there are some advantages to local food?
Well, obviously. I mean, people have been eating local food since the beginning of humanity. And at the same time, when local food offers the best quality-price ratio, well, everybody buys it. I mean, I live in the countryside outside of Toronto. Local farmers who produce good seasonal crops have no problem selling them locally. But the problem is that local food activists nowadays want to go beyond what is reasonable, meaning that they push local food when it has no other advantages than being local. Be it taste, being in terms of the price, food safety, these kinds of issues. And this is what me and my co-author, Hiroko Shimizu, really have a problem with.
Isn't part of that, though, part of the locavore activism that we see today, in many ways less about the food and more about a pushback to globalization?
Oh, it's exactly that. And also corporations, large corporations. There's been a large food counterculture for a long time. I mean, the organic movement has been around for over a century. A lot of the initiatives that local food activists are now promoting, like so-called community-supported agriculture, where they try to bypass wholesalers and retailers, have been around for several decades. So, yeah, no, it's become really a mix of all sorts of ideas, both in terms of not liking the idea of humans playing God with their groceries, but also a backlash against globalization, of depending on foreigners, of not trusting large corporations. So it's a very diverse set of beliefs that are sort of coagulated, in my opinion, around this whole idea of local food.
And one of the things you argue is that we, in order to really understand the system we have now, we need to look at it historically and look at the very reasons why this globalized system of food supply developed in the first place.
Well, exactly, because today people believe that, well, we only have a globalized food supply chain because large corporations force it down our throat. But actually, the system is older than that, and when you go back in history, 2 centuries ago, what you realize is that people were pushing for it essentially to promote food security. The basic problem was that wherever you were on the surface of this planet, be it South China or Northern Europe, you would have bad years. I mean, you would have droughts, floods, pest infestation, earthquakes, tsunamis, and most people were malnourished. And 2 bad harvests in a row would always and everywhere give you a famine. So essentially, what long-distance transportation, mostly through the steam engine, be it on a steamboat, a steamship, or a railroad did, was to make sure that regions that had really good years would be able to channel their surpluses to regions that had really bad years. And a few years down the road, the situation might be reversed. You know, it's a region that had struggled a few years before might have, again, surplus crops and send them elsewhere. So it was really a way of managing risk, if you will, making sure that people would not starve. And large-scale corporations really came long after that.
One of the things you talk about is that this locavore movement or versions of it have a lot of historical antecedents, that there have been many similar movements, including some people may remember the Victory Gardens during World War II, and that each of these movements has sort of come and gone, that they've been fads at particular times.
Yeah, we argue in the book, and I think we document the fact that there have been such movements ever since you've had long-distance trade. So you mentioned those that you see during war times, but you also had a reaction against the advent of the railroad in the United States a century ago, where, let's say, farmers in the less productive regions of Pennsylvania were unable to compete with people who had better growing conditions in Delaware, Virginia, and Maryland. You also had a similar movement during the Great Depression. And what happens is that people only look at what they see right in front of them, meaning a few jobs created in terms of producing food locally. But then they tend to forget that the food always becomes more expensive, and that when you pay more for your food, you actually impoverish people. And poorer people have less money to spend on other things, and in the process destroy more jobs than you create. So these movements come and go, but like the back-to-the-land movement of the hippies in the 60s and 70s, typically they don't leave much of a mark on the landscape.
Talk about the Empire Market example in the UK. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite one. So in the 1920s, you know, the British Empire ruled the world. You had a British colony in every time zone on this planet. But in the United Kingdom, consumers didn't care about stuff that was produced in British colonies. They were buying the best food they could get for the lowest price possible. So the food might be coming in from Germany, from the French colonies, from the United States. And so in the 1920s, to sort of justify the existence and the cost of the British Empire, a movement was begun in the United Kingdom to encourage people to buy Empire. And in that case, the local economy included obviously the United Kingdom, but also Canada, Australia, the African colonies of the British Empire, India. And so you have all these posters that say, well, you know, buy tea from Ceylon, which is today Sri Lanka, canned salmon from Canada, oranges from South Africa, grapes from Australia, lamb from New Zealand. And in the end, what you realize, well, the British people bought lamb from New Zealand, but that's because it was the best product available. Other than that, they just didn't care. And even the whole British Empire wasn't enough of a local economy to actually make sure that this movement would succeed. And so it was abandoned in the 1930s after almost a decade of continuous propaganda that in the end had virtually no effect on British consumers.
You talk about the quality of the product, for example, the lamb in New Zealand. One of the things you talk about is even among local producers, the tremendous discrepancy in terms of quality of product.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I grew up in the countryside. I mean, my parents, well, I was going to say we have a sugar shack, which in the Quebec context means maple syrup, not sugar beet or sugar cane. But, yeah, I mean, like everybody else, I mean, I had no interest in staying in that line of work. Most of the kids I went to school with did not do either, but those that did were the best and the most successful ones, and they ended up buying their neighbor's property and growing their business that way. And so it's not because a firm or a farm is local or small that it is necessarily efficient. The point we make in the book is that there are economies of scale in food production, as with everything else. So you have, on the one hand, large private corporations or large farms, large private holdings that might own a large chunk of land. But then you have also large producers' cooperatives, which have been around for a century and a half. The one we use most, the one we discuss the most in the book is Fonterra, which is a dairy giant agricultural cooperative in New Zealand. They have about 13,000 producers who belong to it. Most of these guys are rather small and medium-sized, but they're able to generate economies of scale that way. And the point that we make to local food activists is that, well, listen, if you want to save local farms, you have two ways to go. Either you sell very expensive products to wealthy consumers, which is not exactly what a local food movement should be about if your goal is to feed the world or help people in inner cities. Or else, you know, go down the producers' cooperative road, generate economies of scale that way, and then you will be able to generate large amounts of quality food at affordable prices. So again, it's just a matter to... But the problem is that food is viewed as something different by many activists. They don't want to recognize that the same basic economic laws apply to food production as to other industries.
What about sustainability and the sustainability argument that goes with the locavore argument?
Well, I sincerely wish it was true, but again, it is not, and the facts are basically saying it, not me. There are two issues at stake here. The problem is that first, historically, when you had to produce most of your food locally before you could move food efficiently over long distances, you ought to grow things like grain close to where you live. And in an area like the Mediterranean, this was a disaster. I mean, people had to generate calories before they generated diversity, and so they would grow grain on hilly slopes and mountainous terrain. And the erosion problems that this created was dramatic. I mean, if you go to the Mediterranean today, it's a devastated landscape in many places. You see, for example, on the Turkish coast, an area, a city which used to be a port, but which is like, you know, 3 miles from the coastline because the landscape was completely eroded and the local port was silted. What happened was that long-distance transportation make it possible to grow crops in the areas that are best suited for them. So, for example, in the United States, with the advent of the railroad, a lot of grain production moved from the Shenandoah Valley, where it was essentially creating the same problems as in the Mediterranean, to areas like the Northern Plains, like North Dakota or Montana, where the landscape is actually ideally suited for grain. So what happened in the Shenandoah is that a lot of farmers then reverted to grazing cattle, which is actually much more gentle on the landscape, or growing orchards, or else abandoned farming and the forest grew back. So in that case, this is just an example that we use to illustrate that long-distance trade is actually great for the landscape. Not only do you produce more food more cheaply and more efficiently, but by concentrating it in the best locations, you actually help heal the land, if I may use that expression. Another issue is that local food activists are really upset about the distance that food travels. But some back of the calculation in the United States tell you that in the overall scheme of things, producing food, about 4% of the energy expense is related to long-distance transportation, and 20 times more, over 80%, to production. So, you know, if you need to heat greenhouses, if you need to pump irrigation water, if you need to use extra feed, for example, extra animal feed because your landscape, your pasture land is not as good as in other locations, well, you end up having a more significant environmental impact. And another issue is latitude. I mean, why is it that many people in North America import, let's say, apples from the southern hemisphere when we can grow apples here? Well, where I grew up, you would pick apples in September. You wanted to eat them in March or April. Well, you needed to leave them in cold storage for several months. You need a lot of energy to do that. You would have losses due to spoilage. The apples wouldn't taste that great after 6 months in storage. But in a place like Chile or New Zealand, their winter is our summer, and they do pick their apples in March or April. So you pick them, you put them on a container ship, which is by far the greenest invention humanity ever devised for moving stuff around. It costs about 1 cent to get an apple from New Zealand to North America. And a few weeks later, it is on our supermarket shelves. So not only is the product fresher and tastier, it is also much greener in the sense of being much more environmentally friendly.
What about this argument, though, about seasonality and the appreciation of seasonality?
Well, that's really weird in as much as, okay, so I'm born in Chicago, so I have to eat seasonally. I'm born in Florida, then I have to eat seasonally. You know, your conscience might care about that, but your body really doesn't. And if you look at what people were doing when we were eating seasonally, you know, you had vitamin deficiency, mineral deficiencies. People were much smaller and sicker than they are today. And defeating seasonality, we argue in the book, has been humanity's greatest triumph. I mean, this is not directly relevant, but essentially we evolved in Eastern Africa in tropical locations. So saying that tropical creatures like humans are born to live in the seasonality of a temperate or even cold climate like the northern U.S. or southern Canada strikes us as odd. And then another thing that we find out is that local food activists only care about seasonality, but they don't care that virtually all of the food that you grow from the United States is not native to the local landscape. I mean, corn is a tropical plant from Mexico, wheat comes from the Middle East, soybeans do come from China, peaches from China, oats from Western Europe. Yet local food activists don't care about that. But somehow they have this fixation on seasonality, which we never quite understood.
One of the things, I want to come back to a point you made earlier about growing crops where they grow best. What about the monoculture argument there, that in fact there isn't the biodiversity?
There is a risk. Yeah, think of, let's say, for example, the potato famine in Ireland. Well, in essence, what we argue is that all systems are at risk, all agricultural systems are at risk. You have risks that target certain types of crops and certain varieties of crops, But then you have things that don't discriminate much. So, for example, where I grew up in Canada, frost, either late frost in the spring or early frost in the fall, is a constant worry of farmers. I mean, if you have a late frost and, let's say, your apple trees are blooming, well, you might lose your apple crop that year. And the frost really doesn't discriminate between crops. And so what we argue in the book is that all agricultural systems are at risk. But the problem with local food activists is that they forget that monocultures are a lot more productive, and they've liberated a lot of people from farming, allowing some of them to become full-time plant scientists. We're able to, you know, tap into the world seed banks, look at hundreds of thousands of varieties of rice, for example, or travel the world to look for wild relatives of rice, to look for cures, if you will, to diseases that might affect monocultural crops. So what we argue in the book is that there will always be problems, but in the grander scheme of things, the wealth and the greater division of labor that monocultures make possible actually make our food system supply safer, not only because when some regions have good years, they can rely on the surplus of other regions, but also because we've generated enough wealth to create people who are full-time plant disease specialists, and who can always try to breed new crops and improve what we have.
One of the other overlays to all of this has been urbanization and the increased urbanization even that we're seeing today. Talk a little bit about this in the context of locavores.
Yeah, well, I'm actually an urban development specialist. I mean, again, I grew up in the countryside, but like many kids, I wanted to leave that life behind me, and so I've always been fascinated by big cities. And in short, the point that we make in the book is that the world civilization really has the same root as cities. There has never been economic development without urbanization. And so we quote Plato in the book, who over 2,000 years ago relates a conversation between Socrates and other philosophers. And these fellows discuss, well, where should we locate our ideal city? And quickly they realize that there is no place in the world that you can locate a city without having long-distance trade, including for food. And what we argue in the book is that cities essentially liberate people from poverty. They make people more productive. Being next to other creative people and suppliers and transportation infrastructure is a vital condition for economic development and prosperity. And so you cannot have economic development without urbanization, and you cannot have urbanization without long-distance trade. And in that sense, what we argue, the locavores don't understand that their prescriptions makes it impossible to have cities. And we have thousands of years of history to back this up. This essentially condemns people to poverty and stagnation.
And yet one of the things that's contributing, this is one of the ironies inherent in this, one of the things contributing to the growth of cities are the creative class that's moving into cities, things that your colleague at University of Toronto, Richard Florida, has talked about, and those are precisely the people who are making the locavore argument.
I know, and we think that they're well-intentioned but misinformed. So the book is, I wouldn't say it's specifically targeted at those people, but we're hoping that some of them will actually listen to our arguments because, you know, it's not because you're very good at, let's say, programming software that you understand much about how economic development proceed or our world came to be. But it is true that, by and large, a local food movement is driven by affluent urbanites who make very good money in the arts or, software programming or things like that. But, yeah, no, you're totally right on that.
And why then, in your view, has this become such a political issue? And you've sort of taken some of the slings and arrows for that, even within the context of discussing your book.
Yeah, well, there are a number of things here. I mean, we're kind of being explicit about the book as to where we came from. I mean, the book was essentially triggered by a guest we had at my department a few years ago who argued that, you know, when you live beyond your local food shed, you're a parasite. And look, the most parasitical people in the world are the Japanese. And my wife happens to be Japanese, so I was kind of conscripted that very evening to explain the benefits of, you know, the Japanese having not enough land to grow their food. It makes more sense for them to specialize in other things and trade those things with people who have plenty of agricultural land and can produce food more efficiently. But beyond that, so it was basically explaining this, the original goal was to explain this basic argument. On the other hand, though, you've got full-time activists who for years were promoting organic and fair trade food. And now you find those at Walmart. So what are these activists going to do? Just call it a day and say, we've won? No, they really resent large corporations. They really resent international trade. And so they've been pushing these things increasingly coercively on institutions like university. Like my university has a number of activists trying to ensure that we pay more for the food that we feed our students than we should. And also on army bases, government agencies, prisons, and stuff like that. So honestly, if it was just a fad and if people only did it because it made them feel better and they were misinformed, we might have written the book to at least try to convey some truth in advertising. But as the movement is becoming more coercive, you know, we felt the need to perhaps be a bit more, how should I put it, direct and in their face in terms of how wrong-headed they are, in our opinion.
And talk about the urban farmers markets that have grown up as a result of this movement.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people have to ask themselves, well, why is it that we have big supermarkets today? Because farmers market is essentially what you had throughout human histories in cities. You know, people who would set up stalls in some open plaza and people would come and buy the stuff. Why is it that we move beyond that? Well, the thing is that you go back to centuries and you look at what the local food activists of the time were saying, and the major complaint that they had is that you could not trust local businessmen and local farmers because a lot of them, for example, had an incentive to add rice powder to cream, water to milk or beer or wine, chicory to coffee. And what happened over time, the market answer to these problems was the development of brands. So one of the first brands in the United States was Quaker Oats. The founders were not Quakers, but Quakers had the reputation of being trustworthy. So putting a Quaker man on the box of oats was a good thing, at least in terms of trying to convey some notions of trust. But the good thing about Quaker Oats is that wherever you bought it in the United States, you would get the exact same product, and you know it would not have been adulterated. And then supermarkets came along because, well, you know, there are such things as economies of scale. The best small retail stores became bigger as they were better than other small retail stores. And the advantage that they have today in terms of being trustworthy is that they're very open to lawsuit if they lie about what they do. But farmers market, though, have the same trust issues that they had two centuries ago. It's not so much that they might, let's say, again, put rice powder into cream, but that little fly-by-night operations have strong incentives to lie to, you know, a number. If you Google farmers market and frauds, you will find a number of stories telling you that the only local characteristic of the food that is sold by some people at some farmers market is that it was bought at the local Costco. I mean, selling Costco food under false pretense will not kill anybody. I mean, Costco food is perfectly safe and stuff. And but you might pretend that a conventional apple was grown organically within a few miles of a farmer's market. And even if you catch the guy who's lying to you, what are you going to do about it? He's not worth suing, and he's not really going to get in trouble. And so what we argue in the book is that large retailers have actually a much more of an incentive to give you truth in advertising in terms of what they sell you, whereas local farmer's markets have less mechanism to actually enforce and promote truth and trust between people.
And part of the genius, for example, of Whole Foods is that it manages to cater to both markets.
Well, exactly. And I mean, but there are new competitors emerging now that Whole Foods has been successful. But the thing with Whole Foods is that, again, it is targeted at an upper-crust customer base or, you know, upper-middle-class consumers, whereas the whole shtick of local food activists is to say that, well, we will provide more affordable and fresher food for, let's say, people of lesser means. No, I'm sorry. I mean, you might feel good about it. It's a bit like the wine market in a way. You know, you can have perfectly good wine for your family, which is not of the highest quality, and you have people who will obviously produce better quality wine that you might want to consume for special occasions. Well, you know, if you consume higher quality wine all the time, good for you, but don't pretend that you're saving the planet or helping poor people. You're not. And in many ways, this is what the local food movement has become, selling more expensive food to upper middle class consumers.
And part of that is a certain romanticism that comes with, particularly for people that have grown up in urban environments, a certain romanticism that they can sort of touch the farmer that yeah. grew their food.
That's the thing, and the thing that I remember from my youth is I was not the one who was selling food at farmers market, but I remember how tired my neighbors were. They would work like 18 hours a day. They would leave their farm at 2 o'clock. They would go sell their food at the farmers market. Maybe things are different today. It might be that on a California farm, for example, the help does all the work and the farmer has plenty of time to schmooze, but I suspect that this is not exactly the case. And so, you don't know who sells you, the people who manufacture your watch or your clothes, or, again, the software or the hardware that helps you set up, farmers market and community-supported agriculture. But somehow, people tend to believe that by meeting people at farmers market, they will somehow improve their social and spiritual life. Well, good for you. I mean, if the farmer is still able to chat with you for several minutes, then so much the better. But on the other hand, I mean, in my experience, these people at harvest time are very tired, and not everybody you meet in life will be your best friend. So it's like everything else. You might get to know a farmer very well and want to help him, but you should help him for the right reason, not because you feel compelled to essentially keep him in business for charitable reasons.
Pierre Desrochers, the book is The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. Pierre, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you.